Ah, hello there. Servus. My name is Haishan Wade, and you're listening to This Week in Geopolitics, where we take a look at the events of yesterday and see how they fit the geopolitical realities of today. And what do I have for you today? Today we have... We're going to talk about NATO getting desperate, the recent comments made by French President Emmanuel Macron. We're going to talk a little bit about the immigration crisis in America with the recent killing of Leck and Riley. And then we'll talk about the recent Michigan primary, as well as the much more recent Supreme Court decision regarding Trump being on the ballot. All that and more coming up. Alrighty, let's get into the rapid-fire news. And first, once again, thank you to John for becoming a supporter of the show through the support feature on Spotify. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And now we'll get into the rapid-fire news. So, this just in. Joe Biden is now eating fried chicken with black people in an attempt to appeal to black voters. Now, every analyst that I've spoken to, all anonymous sources, of course, but every analysts that I have spoken to, don't ask how I know them, okay, all right, these are anonymous sources, we don't want to disclose them, we don't want to expose them, all right, we want to treat them with respect, but all, my many, many, many anonymous sources that are completely and totally legitimate, I swear, they all inform me, right, they have all informed me that this masterstroke of politics is likely to score Biden 95% plus of the African American vote. That's what they're telling me. Don't ask where I got them from. Don't ask where they came. That's not important. I mean, look. Let's be fair here. Some stereotypes exist for a reason. I am black, so don't try to cancel me. All right, we do like fried chicken. All right, we like fried chicken. All right, we do like watermelon, and we do like Kool-Aid. All right, these stereotypes exist for a reason. That being said, this is terrible politics. Fried chicken is like you know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of when Hillary, it was, she had hot sauce in her purse when she went the Charlemagne the Breakfast Club with Charlemagne. Oh, brother. Which one's worse? You ain't black or having a nice family fried chicken meal with a lovely black family? Well, at least you gotta give him credit. This one's more wholesome than the other two. I wonder if they had a side of Kool-Aid. All right, let me stop. But yeah, all of my anonymous sources, all my analysts that I can't tell you the name of, they're telling me this is gonna give them 95%+ of the vote. Cause this right here is really gonna resonate with the black people. All right, he's one of us now. Okay, he's one of us now. He's a twin now. But anyway, this is the goofiest year ever. Didn't I say it? This is the goofiest fucking year ever, and the craziest election. So on the other side of this equation, we have Trump down at the southern border, and he's apparently garnered the votes of the Mexican army. There's a video of him standing at like a border wall constructed by the Texans. And on the other side, you see the Mexican military patrolling their side of the border, as they should. I mean, these criminals can't come to America from the southern border without operating in Mexico. They're criminals here and they're criminals there, which is why we have common interest in getting this shit under control. And that's why Trump worked with Mexico and with Guatemala to, you know, stop the flow of illegal immigrants and to, you know, sort of throttle the flow of income for these gangs, because part of their income is through the human trafficking of people from Mexico to the United States. That's a source of income for them. So if you can deprive them of that income by enforcing our southern border, getting Mexico to enforce its southern border, and then from Guatemala to enforce its southern border, you not only do you create a sort of bottleneck, right? Where instead of trying to police 2,000 miles of U.S.-Mexico border, you can shrink the mileage down to just a few hundred if you start from the Guatemalan border, and then you have another line of defense at the Mexican border, and then you have Mexico, the state apparatus in Mexico, actually enforcing their own sovereignty, and then at the last final level, you have a fucking wall at the U.S. border, and of course, we have more resources to deal with these things than they do, any one of our neighbors to the south, and this was Trump's policy, remain in Mexico, etc. But yeah, he goes to the southern border, and surprise, surprise, the so-called racist is being cheered on by the Mexican army, because when they see him, you see like a small little platoon of men walking on the far side of the what appears to be the Rio Grande River, and you see like a small platoon of men, and then Trump, he waves at them, and they say, Trump, Trump, and then and Trump waves and does a little fist bump that he does. A very peculiar moment in time that no one could have ever seen coming. Either there's infinite jokes about how no one saw this on their 2024 bingo cards. At this point, we may as well throw the bingo cards out and just trade it in for a game of Pokino. We'll have a better chance of filling these boards up. But I digress. That was unexpected, but very wholesome at the same time. Very weird but wholesome moments in our politics right now. And hopefully it stays that way, although we all know it's not going to. But, you know, yeah, we'll enjoy it while it lasts. The Houthis on the other side of the world, have destroyed underwater cables linking Europe and Asia. Now, I could have sworn, maybe this is just me losing my faculties, right? But I could have sworn we had, like, a whole alliance and a whole coalition meant to stop them from doing these types of things. You know, just doing... I thought we were gonna get this under control, and we had sent these warships, and we had like $4 billion in the aid package that's supposed to go to fighting these people in the Red Sea, and because of course that's gonna solve the problem. Just spend $4 billion more on it. It's not like we spend $750 billion on our military every year. It's not like that money is supposed to achieve anything when it comes time to use the money. Of course not. No, when you're supposed to spend more, that's just the maintenance. When you have to actually use the military, now you have to spend more money on it. Everyone knows that that's how it works, you know, except for the Russians. When they spend money on it, what they use the money on, they can use later on. Us, the Pentagon just loses $2 trillion twice when they get audited. On two separate occasions, and we have no artillery shells, and apparently we're incapable of dealing with Houthis, pirates, because this is an act of piracy. It's not quite terrorism as much as it is piracy, as thin of a line as it can get at certain times, and we have no counter to this. Like, it's very impressive. Like, to give kudos and credit where credit is due, it's very impressive. These guys, they have a whole naval blockade going using drones, revolutionizing drone warfare and drone doctrine right alongside the Russians, and in a way that nobody could have anticipated. Piracy with drones. Everyone was talking about drone swarms and AI and Terminators, and here go the Houthis with, yeah, we're just going to get this little quad drone, we're going to bomb a ship. Yeah, now we control the straits, and you're gonna do what we say, or else you're not getting through. Wow, simple and effective, and it's so basic that modern navies, I should say, are not properly equipped to deal with this unless you have really good electronic jamming capabilities, or you're able to pinpoint where the drone operators are, and then you bomb them. These are the ways that the Russians have found ways around drone warfare on the battlefields of Ukraine. Again, many lessons to be learned from that war. The smart people are learning these lessons. Now, what's important, because, you know, I just casually call myself smart, but what's important is not that just that the smart people learn these lessons, it's that the smart people in the right places learn these lessons. Because I'm just your average regular person with a podcast. What who needs to be learning these lessons are our military high command and our soldiers. They're the ones who need to be learning this lesson. They're the ones who need to be watching what the Russians are doing like a hawk and then translating that into new doctrines for the 21st century. Perhaps long term, we don't know, but at the very least, the 10-15 year term, because what's happening in Ukraine right now is redefining modern warfare as we know it. And quite frankly, we didn't really know it to begin with, because we haven't had a major war like this in a really long time. So the Russians and the Ukrainians are collectively defining what modern warfare actually looks like between two industrialized modern military powers. This is what modern war looks like. And when you have two countries that are actually capable of fighting back against each other, not just us bombing a third world country in the Middle East. But I'll digress. You can use electronic jamming to fight drones. You can bomb the drone operator because then the drone can't do anything. And apparently these lessons are lost on our Navy because we're not bombing drone operators. Granted, not that we really need to be over there to fucking begin with, but if you're going to be over there, you could at least be effective in what you're trying to accomplish. There's no sense in endangering American lives, and because that's what our soldiers are. They're American lives. These are American citizens that you're just throwing out there. Sure, they signed up to fight for this country, but that doesn't mean be wasteful with their life and their sacrifice. Like, if you're going to send them over there, you should have a clearly defined plan to win. Clearly defined goals and objectives, and clearly defined means by which you can reach these objectives. We have none of that. We just sent the ships over, and now they're just loitering in a war zone that they don't need to be in, achieving nothing. And it's a damn shame. And the Houthis are just running roughshod over us. And it's embarrassing, and it's embarrassing. There really isn't much to say that I haven't already said over the course of the months of this blockade. It's still impressive when you're looking at it from their perspective. And then it's still just as embarrassing that we're just sitting here looking at it. But alas, this is not likely to end anytime soon. By the time this ends, the war in Gaza will be over. And that's a completely different subject of conversation. Now, we were talking about Biden and Trump and the things that they're doing in the craziest election year of all time. But we're not the only ones having elections here. A lot of people around the world are having elections, and one of those countries is the UK. And there's all and in big elections there's always run up and elections leading up to the big elections. And since we're looking at elections here, George Galloway, a former Labour Party MP and prominent Scottish political commentator who was most prominently featured on Russia Today News. That's where I saw him. That's where I see him most of the time, whenever I do see him. Occasionally he'll be on the Duran. But George Galloway, this former Labour Party MP, prominent political commentator, he has won a parliamentary election in Rochdale. The UK, running under the banner of the Workers' Party. And he won more votes than both of the other candidates from the two mainstream parties in the United Kingdom, that being Labour, Democrats, and Tories, Republicans, just to sort of give you an idea of it, if it was America, which parties they are, but these are different parties, and obviously they stand for different things. But yeah, British politics is a strange sort of warped mirror image of our own in that it's very much a two-party system where, again, the Tories are like the Republicans and the Labour Party is like the Democrats, but with much deeper differences the further down you go. But deeper as defined by the establishment, because as we have observed, and as many people living in the United Kingdom have observed, the Tories and the Labour Party have essentially exposed themselves as being two wings of the same party, similar to Republicans and Democrats in the United States. So in that regard, it is also, again, a warped mirror image of the United States. Now, the difference between the UK and the United States is, one, they have a parliamentary system, and we have our electoral constitutional system. But another difference is that we have MAGA, right? And MAGA has made a lot more progress in sort of the hostile takeover of the parties and of national politics than any political force in the UK has. Like, you have Nigel Farage, who would sort of be their equivalent to Donald Trump, but now you have George Galloway, who, to compare him to, say, a populist over here, would be like Bernie Sanders before Bernie Sanders sold out. A lot of people still bitter about that one, but that's the way it is. But this time, he has, in this case, George Galloway, the sort of populist from the left, he has come in on the Workers' Party, so Socialist Party, and that's sort of much closer to his political leanings. He won more votes than both of the other candidates of the other two mainstream parties. When this signals to me, the birth of a left-wing anti-war opposition party and oppositional force to the ruling establishment in the country. Now, whether or not, say, a Nigel Farage would be able to garner the kind of support among the right-wing forces in the country remains to be seen. So we might actually, again, in the sort of warped mirror image comparison I keep making here, we might see conservative populism dominate in the United States, and then more left-wing populism dominate in the UK. We might see that, and that'll be a very interesting comparison, especially given how similar the political systems are as they stand. And it'll be interesting to see how the Workers' Party under Galloway, should they gain enough steam and momentum to truly overthrow and challenge their political class over there, which I feel is something that'll come, right? Because it's happening all across Europe at the moment. So it'll be very interesting to compare the path forward that they take when they overthrow their ruling establishment from a left-wing perspective, and contrast that to how we go about it, because we're on the verge of ousting these people on our damn selves, except we're going to be going in a completely opposite direction to anything socialist. Like, the closest to socialism we're going to have is a reformed Medicare and Medicaid system, perhaps a new healthcare system that Trump has promised, but we'll see about that, and Social Security, which Social Security is perhaps the best social program there is. Because it's not supposed to be a social program in the first place. It's your money put away for your retirement. And the best reform for that I can think of is you put the retirement accounts into the hands of the people instead of a bureaucrat in Washington. Because clearly the bureaucrats in Washington just keep taking the money out of the pot, and then they don't want to give it back. And it's like, we don't have the money to do that. We have $100 billion for Ukraine, but we can't fund your pensions. It's like, okay, bastard. But yeah, that's about as socialist as it's going to be over here in the United States. We're going in a completely opposite direction. Watch Argentina. That's going to be sort of the testing the waters for the kinds of policies we're going to see in the United States. But it'll be interesting to compare and contrast the two, because right now we're kind of similar. We have immigration problems, and you have very similar politics on the left and the right. With the divergence that comes from who exactly is the one to overthrow the establishment, we could see America and Britain take completely opposite trajectories. And that'll be very interesting to watch. But I'll digress. His election, nonetheless, even though I disagree with him politically in terms of domestic politics, I wouldn't want him running things over here, it's probably going to be good for the UK. I mean, these ruling establishments don't do anything for the people. They're globalists, they're anti-humanists, and they don't like people. And they're Satanists. But it'll be very interesting to see what he does. It'll be very interesting to see an anti-war voice gaining prominence in Britain, as we see anti-war voices gaining prominence in the United States. And if it has to be from a left-wing perspective, then so be it. At the very least, it'll keep them out of a war, you know? But I'll digress. And last, aside from that, there was also the response that Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, gave. Because following the election of George Galloway, this guy comes to the steps of the Parliament building and gives a speech, which is, this kind of thing is usually reserved for, like, really big events. He's talking about an election where his political opposition has now gained a say in the Parliament. And he's talking about the enemies within. I hope George Galloway's in for a fight. I hope he's ready for that. But alas, that's enough about Britain. There'll be something to watch and observe. All of Europe will be something to watch and observe. Because all of Europe, every nation in Europe is probably going to go about this different ways as each of them reclaim their sovereignty. So, again, I really want to stress that this idea of a singular, unified, collective West is very, very, very artificial, and it only exists in the context of an American empire. But that empire is in decline, not just externally, but internally. We're about to overthrow that empire right now, this year. So when this empire dies, both in Ukraine, Taiwan, Israel, and at home, when we overthrow these people in the halls of our own government, so too will go this concept of Western solidarity. I talked about this in last week's episode. And I think that because of how widely used this term, the West this and the West that, because of how widely used it is, I feel it's important that we should be aware that this change is coming. As the European states reclaim and regain their sovereignty, just as we are about to do, they're going to go in different directions. Because what a lot of analysts in geopolitics, because I listen to a lot of people, a lot of political commentators, what they don't really understand in the modern sense, because if you go back in time, they can clearly define that every country has different interests and different means of going about their interests. But for some reason, in the modern era, we're all put into this sense that every country in Europe and the United States, of all places, we all have the same interests. And that is just fundamentally impossible. That is just fundamentally impossible. We are a country in North America, right? How can we have the same interests as Italy? And not only that, all of the nations of Europe have had different interests for their entire history. So how do they all have the same interests now? Oh, what, because they're Western? They've all been Western before. Well, how do they all have the same interests now? It doesn't make sense. And that's why I say that this is artificial. That's one of the reasons I say it's artificial. But it's a term that's very popularly used. The West. And it's an easy catch-all term to refer to the United States and Europe. But as we head into this new era, which is right around the corner, right? The definitive moment is right around the corner, whether that's a BRICS summit where they announce their new interbank payment system, where they're going to have their transactional currency, whether that's the overthrow of the U.S. imperial apparatus here in the United States with the 2024 elections, whether that's with various populist uprisings in Europe. This is going to manifest a lot of different ways in a lot of different places in Africa. It's manifesting through various national liberation movements. But with the death of this empire will come the death of this idea of Western solidarity. And it's going to be very interesting to watch how every country, as they regain their sovereignty, either by choice or by lament, because a lot of them would like to keep things the way they are. But as countries regain their sovereignty, we're going to go back to what should have been the understanding the entire time, which is that every country has their own interests, and every country is going to act in their interests. And it'll be very interesting to see how the Europeans move forward, tackling the challenges, particularly of low birth rates and economic decline. That being said, the last but not least, we have Russia advancing slowly and steadily in the background as all of these events transpire. And in time, that advance is going to speed up. It's March now, so we get ever closer to that moment of no return, that point of no return for Ukraine. But that is the rapid fire. So now, we'll get into the meat of this episode. And we'll start the meat of this episode by talking about NATO. NATO getting desperate. Because last week, French President Emmanuel Macron, he said that there is no consensus on this, but deploying Western troops to Ukraine in order to prevent Russia from winning is not ruled out. Not ruled out. So whose troops are we sending? Because he's saying this, it's not ruled out. It's always a possibility. Comments in line with the stupidity that took place just prior to this war back in 2021 and early 2022, when you had Jens Stoltenberg, and I use him as the poster child for how we were the problem. And the irresponsible statements that were made leading up to this war, Kamala Harris saying that, we're open to Ukraine join NATO. You have fucking Jens Stoltenberg saying that Russia doesn't have legitimate security interests in its own neighborhood that has invaded it multiple times in the past. At least three times that we can count in recent memory, and more times the further back in time you go. Yeah, they don't have a legitimate security interest, apparently, to him. But not one to be outdone. Macron is now talking about boots on the ground in Ukraine. NATO boots on the ground in Ukraine. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the whole point of fighting this proxy war against Russia was specifically so that we didn't have to put boots on the ground, you know, theoretically, because we never had to put boots on the ground over there anyway. I'm talking about America here. But theoretically, the goal of this entire experiment, this entire project in Ukraine, was to fight Russia over there so we don't fight them over here, right? Which technically would be true for France, because they're on the opposite end of the European continent. Wasn't the whole point of giving Ukraine hundreds of billions of dollars worth of aid and weapons and munitions, wasn't the whole point of that? And training and military assistance and intelligence sharing? Wasn't the whole point of that so that you didn't have to put troops on the ground in Ukraine? And to add to that, wasn't Ukraine winning? I could have sworn Ukraine's been winning this entire time. What would they? I thought Russia was losing. I thought Russia lost 50% of their military forces. I thought they lost 300,000 men. 80% of what they had at the beginning of the war. I thought they lost it all. What happened? Did Ukraine just win too hard that too many people left the front line and went back home? Like the Confederates after the Battle of Bull Run? They win the battle and they're like, you know what? This is going to be easy. We're going home. You guys have got this. We beat them in the first battle. We're just a ragtag group of nobodies. We're just regular people. We beat the Union Army, okay? We beat the Union. We're going home. All right? Did Ukraine just win so hard that they that people just let go of their enlistments and went back to their daily lives? Is that what happened? And now they're losing? What happened? I thought Ukraine was winning. I thought all this was so that you didn't have to put troops in Ukraine. I thought that this was the greatest investment ever. According to Lindsey Graham, is the greatest money we've ever spent. Now, I'm attributing things that the French president hasn't said, but it's not like he is out of line with these viewpoints, especially if he's now talking about boots on the ground in Ukraine. But what strikes me is the fact that I know France doesn't have that much of an army. Like, they're up there in terms of NATO countries, but quite frankly, that's not exactly a very high bar. There's United States, there's Turkey, there's Greece, and then there's France, right? Because Greece has a large army, like 500,000 in their armed services, and so does Turkey. Turkey has 500,000 as well. And that's because neither of them trust each other, and they're always prepared to fight a war with each other. in the case of Turkey, they're probably gearing up to fight a very different war that'll reshape the balance of power in their east, which given the propensity, the increasing propensity for peace in the Middle East, might reshape their attitudes towards their West. But we'll see about that. Turkey's a very oddball and very much a wild card in this changing world order. But aside from Turkey, aside from Greece, there's France, right? So it's, they're not a slouch. I'll give them that much. They are no slouch militarily when compared to the rest of NATO. And that's the caveat here. When compared to the rest of NATO, France is not a slouch. They do produce all their own military equipment. That's a plus, right? They don't have to purchase anything from other people unless they get into an actual fight and they run out of munitions, which is exactly what's happened all across of Europe. Everyone's out of munitions. No one can produce shells. No one can produce tanks. No one's really producing aircraft like that. The Russians are outproducing all of NATO in every aspect of military production, except for planes. Maybe, because I'm getting some news now. I saw a video talking about how many planes that the Russians have rebuilt. I have to watch that one. I have to watch it. But I want to compare those numbers with the numbers of planes that we have produced and NATO has produced, because they've outproduced us in every other realm. They've outproduced us everywhere, especially where it counts, which is artillery. We've been outproduced. The French are not fighting the Russians for more than 2 days. The British aren't fighting the Russians for more than 1 day. And that's assuming that they could land the army over there to fight them to begin with the current state of their military. So what? Well, what this guy's really saying when he talks about sending Western troops, NATO troops in Ukraine is not out of the question. We're not ruling that out. We're not ruling any of that out because we have to stop Russia from winning. What he's really saying is that he's willing to send his troops to Ukraine for the sole purpose of dying and triggering Article 5 to drag the United States into a direct conflict with Russia. And why would he, now why would he do that, you might ask? Why would he do that? Well, because we don't like Putin. We don't like Putin, and we don't want to ever look at or talk to or negotiate with a Russian. It's this intense racism towards Russia that is driving a lot of this policy. Because a lot of these people who advocate for these policies treat Russia as though it was the Antichrist. Now say I'm wrong. Tell me I'm wrong. You can't, because that's how these people operate. They treat Russia like it was the Antichrist, even though they're not. They're really not. They treat Putin as though he was the next Hitler. He is also not Hitler. He is not Hitler at all. He is a man. He is a man that you can talk to. He is a man who means what he says when he says it. So you can, if he says he's going to do something, you can trust that he's going to do it. Now, they've established in their head this fiction that the Russians are just liars all the time and that they can't be trusted, when really it's our own politicians who are habitual and impulsive liars. Putin does what he says he's going to do. You can like what he's going to do or you can dislike it, but at least you know that you're getting a fair hand when he says he's going to do something. They don't like Russia and they don't like having to deal with Russia. And this has been true for the Europeans ever since Russia sort of bursted onto the scene in Europe as this gargantuan that no one European power could truly best, except for the Germans that one time in World War I. But that was due more for internal reasons in Russia than it was for them winning the war militarily. Which they did win militarily, let's not pretend that they were at Moscow and Leningrad before Leningrad became Leningrad, St. Petersburg. But yeah, that one time, Sweden couldn't do it, France under Napoleon couldn't do it, Germany under Hitler couldn't do it, the Poles, the Lithuanians, they couldn't do it. Like, no one country was able to beat Russia because of how big Russia was, and over time, Russia just gained more and more advantages from the sheer mass of their own size, which is an advantage that they continue to have. And this gives them influence. But because they are who they are, and they're different from the Western Europeans, you have the Western Europeans, they just don't want to ever have to deal with the Russians, because the Russians represent a completely, oftentimes opposite worldview to their own. And you know how those liberals are when they start talking about democracy this and democracy that. It's always been this way between the West, which used to just be, you know, Britain, France, maybe Spain, the Netherlands, the West, and Russia. They've rarely gotten along, except for those two times where they had to fight Germany. But they don't like having to deal with people with different viewpoints than theirs. They like being able to stomp on people with different viewpoints than theirs. They don't like having to deal with. They don't like having to account for. They don't like having to accommodate countries with different viewpoints than theirs. They just want to dominate. And they would love to dominate Russia, but Russia's too big and too powerful for them to dominate. And this has usually been the case. There are rare instances where Russia is vulnerable enough to where you can do that, but those instances are rare. And this hatred of Russia carries over to the modern day, to the point where we're talking about NATO boots on the ground in Ukraine, a country that is not in NATO, mind you, to fight Russia, a country that we promised we wouldn't expand NATO towards after the collapse of the Soviet Union, a country that we've made promises that we were going to help end the war in the Donbass to. We promised the Russians we would help end the war in the Donbass. We lied to them for 8 years so we could arm the Ukrainians for a war against Russia. And now that all that has blown up in our face after we overthrew Ukraine's government in 2014, which instigated the war in the Donbass to begin with, after all of this blew up in our face, the only thing these people have to say for themselves is, let's just double down on war with Russia. It's not, oh, we were wrong, oh, my bad, we made a mistake, we fucked up, guys. No, it's, we're just going to go to war with Russia now. That's what he's saying. We're just going to go to war with Russia now. Ukraine is losing, all right? Fighting an indirect war with Russia isn't working, so we're just going to fight a war with Russia now. And all these SEALs are clapping along, or at least that's what I thought was going to happen. But what actually happened was he said this, and then Germany was very quick to distance itself from Macron's statements. Very quick. Which is very peculiar and good for Germany that they did that. Not that they're doing themselves any favors by continuing to fund and arm Ukraine. But at the very least, you haven't gone full retard. But Macron's statements here, while publicly they are being rebuked, there are a lot of these Ukraine simps in the halls of various governments in NATO who agree with everything he just said. And you know they agree with what he just said, because we are all being expected to sacrifice for Ukraine. Suddenly, Ukraine is the noble cause that everyone has to sacrifice for because World War II. Right. Notice the propaganda machine and the way they've shaped the battlefield for the media narrative, right? Support Ukraine or else you're Neville Chamberlain. That's how they frame this. Either you're going to support Ukraine to the bitter end, no matter how much of your own equipment you use up, no matter how much of your economy you throw away, no matter how weak you make yourself in the process by disarming effectively, by giving all your weapons away to Ukraine, no matter how badly it gets for you, either you give weapons to Ukraine and you make the hard decision to keep going along with a really bad policy, or else you're Neville Chamberlain and you're appeasing Hitler. Have you noticed that's how the propaganda machine is working? Now, why is that? Why is that? Oh, it's because all of these leaders who all hate actual democracy, who all hate the idea of their voters getting a say in what they do, all these people who hate Russia with a burning passion, they all have their priorities set on destroying Russia. And because they are so out of touch with their own populace, they don't really care about the consequences of their policies towards their populace, which is why you're seeing all these populist revolts breaking out across NATO countries. But just focusing in back on these ruling classes, they all agree with what Macron said. They all agree. They all talk about it. And there's been multiple threats made over the course of the war to try to convince us, primarily the United States, to send more weapons and more aid to Ukraine. Well, they're fighting the war so that we don't have to. You have to give money and weapons to them. You're a bad person if you don't want to give money and weapons to Ukraine. It's just every dirty tactic in the book, manipulation, blackmail, browbeating. It's at every step of the way, it's just manipulation and propaganda to get us to go along with this. But they wouldn't be going to such lengths if they did not agree with what he said. And again, on multiple occasions, we've heard these comments said before, just from lower rank politicos, not a head of state. And that's what sort of distinguishes this from the other times that we've heard these things. Annalena Baerbock of Germany. Remember when she said she doesn't give a goddamn? Okay, she didn't say all that. Remember when she said she doesn't care what German voters think? We're going to support Ukraine for as long as it takes. Remember when she said that? She meant that. They all meant that. Biden said it for as long as it takes. Blinken said it for as long as it takes. For as long as it takes. For as long as it takes. They all agree with what this guy Macron said. It's just that the taboo was saying it publicly. Macron has said it publicly. Which indicates, one, that he's jumped the gun on this, and that there still isn't really a consensus on whether or not to do this. Well, whether or not now is the time to do this, because they're all talking about it. They all think that it's something they should do, but they don't know if now is the time, or if they should wait a little bit, or if maybe Russia really is going to collapse, or how they're going to go about it exactly. You know, even though they're still going to fuck up on the execution, but you know, they at least want to think about this before they go through with it. This indicates that there's either the plan. The plan is there's a faction of these people who want to go through with this, and he's sort of voicing that to force the hand of the rest of these leaders to double down on the insanity, because you can't walk back the statement, like which made Germany interesting, because they did sort of walk back from his statements. So I think that what he was doing was an attempt to try to get the rest of NATO to sort of nudge them closer to that direction. And by the rest of NATO, I'm really talking about the United States. Because what's the rest of NATO going to do? What is the rest of NATO going to do? They can't do anything. They don't have militaries. It's only the United States. Greece and Turkey are not going to take their troops away from one another because they don't trust in each other. So they're immediately off the table. And that's two of the largest NATO militaries outside of the United States. And then the Turks are preparing for a war against fucking Israel anyway. They're not going to go to war with Russia. Fuck all that. They've already been bribed with a gas hub deal. But this insistence on fighting Russia, a European insistence, because America doesn't need to be over there, right? This Western European insistence on fighting Russia, and an insistence that is even stronger in Eastern Europe, because they were occupied by the Russians for the Cold War, so they really don't like Russia. This European insistence on fighting war with Russia, combined with the incapacity of the European states to fight this battle that they're so eager for, it exemplify exactly why NATO is every bit as dangerous to the United States as it is to Russia. Because who would be fighting this war against Russia if the Europeans don't have the militaries to do so themselves? To even contribute in any real way. It's not going to be the French. It's not going to be the Germans. We already said it's not going to be the Turks or the Greeks. No. It's going to be us. It's going to be us. And that's the goal. What is the purpose of NATO? The purpose of NATO is to keep Russia out, to keep America in, and to keep the Germans down. You keep the Russians out, preventing Western Europeans from ever being challenged in any meaningful way on the continent. You keep America in because America is the only Western country with the strength to challenge Russia. But America is far away. And by keeping America in, you prevent America from distancing itself politically from Europe. And therefore, you can cement the power of the Western powers, the Western European powers, on the continent of Europe. So that they never have to consult with or talk to or make any kind of agreement with a Russian. You know, they are blatantly racist toward the Russians. It is such a strong and unavoidable observation at this point. And then there's number three, you keep Germany down because Germany is the second most powerful nation in Europe after Russia. They're the third most powerful Western country, again, after the United States and Russia. And because of that power, because of that strength, if they were truly sovereign and independent, they would be a separate center of power in Europe, and thus another voice whose opinion matters, that the Western powers, Britain, France, that they would have to consult with when trying to do things in Europe. And they don't like that. They already don't like having to deal with the Russians. They certainly don't want to have to deal with a third pole of power, which is Germany. And they want America there with them so they can always impose their will on the continent. But if NATO goes away, the Russians can come in and provide a true balance of power in Europe. The Germans can come up, which would also work towards a balance of power in Europe. And America can leave, which would force the Western Europeans to talk to the other Europeans instead of trying to impose their will on the continent, as they always try to do. That's the purpose of NATO, to keep us tied down in Europe, to keep the Germans down, and to keep the Russians out. The purpose of NATO is to prevent a balance of power in Europe, and to maintain Western European dominance of this continent, using America as the sort of engine for that strength and dominance. And you can see this on full display with these comments from the French president. He wants Americans to go fight and die against Russians so that Western Europe can maintain Western liberalism as a whole, because it's not just Western Europe, but that's the sort of epicenter of it. But so that he wants Americans to go fight and die against Russians so that Western liberalism can maintain its dominance on the continent. He wants Americans to go fight and die against Russians so that the Russians don't ever get a win, so that Putin doesn't get a win. We're not going to let Putin win. You notice that it's always personal. It's always about stopping Putin. We have to stop Putin. We can't let Putin have a win. We can't let Putin have this and let Putin have that. It's so childish. But that's the nature of the people we're dealing with. These are the people who run your countries. In NATO, if you live in NATO, which unfortunately we do, but perhaps we won't for much longer. But I'll digress. That part remains to be... Whether or not we will actually end up leaving NATO does remain to be seen. I think the destruction of Ukraine is going to be the catalyst. That's going to be a very, very big catalyst for a lot of countries very deeply reconsidering NATO. The United States in particular, that's the destruction of Ukraine, in spite of having spent hundreds of billions of dollars on Ukraine. And all the nonsense that we have had to endure in our domestic politics to maintain that flow of goods and supplies to Ukraine just for it all to blow up in our face and result in nothing, that's going to be the catalyst, I believe, for us leaving NATO. But that remains to be seen. In the meantime, we get boneheaded proposals like this from boneheaded people. So now, we will get into a little bit of the immigration crisis in the United States. Because there's been more fuel added to the flames of discontent. I almost said rebellion, but it's not there. It's not quite there yet. Although we have a lot of months to go before we get to the election. At the rate we're going, it might end up being that way. for reasons of foreign policy with Gaza, as things get worse over there. I've seen a lot of convoys of people fly, and I say convoys, I'm talking people in their cars driving down the street with various political slogans and stuff on their car, and they have the Palestine flag and the Ukraine flag. I've occasionally, though not as much, I've occasionally seen people with Israeli flags, but that one's more rare. So I'm not saying that there isn't necessarily more support for Israel in the United States. What I am saying is that the support for Palestine is more present. It's more visible. And perhaps that's because it's more energetic. Although we will... And not only that, but you can also see that this reflected in the votes from the Michigan primary. We just talked about how Biden, the Democrat primary, there was 100,000 uncommitted votes. That's a protest vote to Biden over what's happening in Gaza. So for as much talk that you'll see from a lot of more conservative commentators, I maintain the position, one, that we don't need to be over there, first and foremost. Two, that we don't need to be giving money to Israel, because why? Foreign aid is a treasonous concept to me. Three, I don't think that there's a consensus in the United States as to what the value of that alliance is anymore. And given that there is no consensus on that, it is inappropriate to maintain a position of alliances that require a consensus among the populace to move forward. Because you can't say that our country is committed to you and half of your country doesn't value the commitment. And it's not even just half. I mean, you're talking, the Democrats don't know if they should be supporting the Jews because it's Israel, or if they should be supporting the Palestinians because the Palestinians have a genocide being committed against them. And then the Republicans are split because you have the mainline Republicans who always want to, who've never seen a war that they didn't like, who are have always simped for Israel, and simping for Israel is just normal for them. Israeli money influencing American elections is just normalized for them. They think that's perfectly fine, all right? So these are the hardcore, spank-me-harder-daddy-Israel simps that represent the Republican old school. And then there's the new school of Republicans who are sovereigntists, who are nationalists, who are saying, wait a second, Israel's not America. Israel's not the 51st state. Why are we just handing out money like candy to Israel? Why can't they defend themselves? Why does it always have to be us? Why do we have to give them $4 billion a year? Let them fight Hamas, all right? That's their job. That's their war, not ours. What are we doing over there? So on the right, there's no consensus. On the left, there's no consensus. And then when you put the whole together, there's definitely no consensus. So why are we trying to maintain an alliance at this moment in time? That we are, even if the alliance was important, we are functionally incapable of honoring that alliance. Right, just based off the lack of any kind of consensus, because the second you go all in on an alliance, well, now you have political opposition. There is no consensus on the value of these alliances, so why are we trying to stay attached to them? If they're important, we can come back to them later on. But we do not value these alliances, and I would say that change is a good thing, because these alliances, quite frankly, don't need to exist. America doesn't... why does a country in North America need to have a say in the Middle East and Europe and Asia and Africa? We don't. None of these places matter to us. And the changes you're seeing happening are actually a return to normal for the United States. And that's what a lot of people who endorse the status quo don't quite understand. That's what a lot of people who don't like MAGA and don't like populism don't understand. This is what America returning to normal looks like. But America's been involved in everything for so long that most people alive today don't have a frame of reference for an America that is anything other than interventionist. But they're going to find out very quickly. But alas, there's a revolt, the possibility of wholesale revolts aside, coming back to the issue of immigration, which has topped the charts as the number one issue that voters are concerned with in the United States. A recent killing has now made the news. And it's a killing of a University of Georgia graduate, Lakin Riley. Lakin Riley was killed by an illegal immigrant from Venezuela, right? His name was Jose Ibarra. Now, the perpetrators of the killing, I said the perpetrators of the killing because I'd written that before I found out what his name was. The perpetrator of the killing was apparently caught by law enforcement twice before this incident. He was caught twice. He was caught once in New York, and then for shoplifting, and then a second time in Georgia for something regarding really bad activities with children, right? So two occasions that he should have been deported, or at the very least one. But he was let go on both occasions. So this event, this killing, that should have never happened, has happened because of a deliberate policy agenda that is influencing our law enforcement. Now, you can put blame on the law enforcement for enforcing unjust laws, but at the end of the day, you have to blame the lawmakers. Why is our life this way? And why does it have to be this way? We don't think it has to be this way, but you make it this way. This girl should never have died. But she has died. Like, we have these... Let me back up here. You have so many people who really want to go to bat for the illegal immigrant, right? You have a lot of people who really would like to go to bat for the illegal immigrant. But what they miss in the process of doing that are a lot of fundamentals. One, you see a lot of the pro-illegal immigration crowd who get hyper-emotional about this. They miss the fact that this is illegal immigration. And they think that illegal means the person. No person is illegal. No. The process by which you came into the country broke our immigration laws. And thus, that is how you are illegal immigrant. So, right off the bat, the pro-immigration side don't even recognize the concept of legal and illegal immigration into a country. So right off the bat, they're behind the curve. Secondly, they act and want to make policy as though America hasn't let in millions of illegal immigrants every year for decades now. And they want to, they don't have a frame of reference for how that could possibly impact the mood, the national mood towards accepting more people. And so in the process of advocating for more and more people, as there are already more and more people living here, they just set themselves up for failure. And by constantly trying to defend people who are not citizens, and by saying, we need to give them this, and we need to give them that, and how many times have you heard, we just got to give them the ability to work, and we have to give them this, and we have to give them health care, and we have to give them all these things that our government is never concerned about giving American citizens. So then you have a hypocrisy. How can you claim to be caring about us when you're caring more about them? How is it that we never have money for us? There's always an issue with the budget when we ask for something, but you can find millions and tens of millions and billions of dollars to accommodate people who already shouldn't be here. What about us? Is the question that gets asked. And a lot of the pro-immigration crowd, they just really don't like accepting the consequences of their policy. And so because of that, you end up in these situations that just make advocating for their policy worse. Because how are you going to advocate open borders effectively? How are you going to advocate accepting everyone in because everyone's just here for a better life? Well, that argument dies every time something like this happens where you have an illegal immigrant who should have been deported multiple times, getting away with these crimes. I mean, he bashed her skull in after raping her. Jose Ibarra raped Lakin Riley and then bashed her skull in. Like, this is going to be used against you. Like, just playing from the side of, let's say I was in favor of mass immigration into the United States. I'm not trying to have anything like this happen because it embarrasses me. I'm not trying to have anything like this happen because it hurts my cause. I want illegal immigrants... first of all, I'd want them to come legally, first of all. that's how you come to a reasonable point of view. The idea, and you saw this with the debate over that trash border bill that the Senate had to offer, back when the details were sort of leaked, but not all of the details, and you had people talking about, oh, the Republicans, they say they want border... they want it to secure the border, but they have the opportunity to do it, and they're not taking it. And then we find out that the border bill was going to let in 2 million illegal immigrants a year legally, with no repercussion. Well, no, that's a terrible bill. And then you have the defenders of this saying, you have to meet us in the middle. Our policy is open borders. You're saying close the border. You have to meet us in the middle. And that's a lot of the problems with today's politics, where people try to take the middle of the road approach, which on any other occasion is a wise thing to do. They say the truth is somewhere in the middle. Well, in the case of this, open borders, but between leaving your door unlocked at night and closing the door and locking it, you're not going to take the middle of the road position and say, we're just going to leave the door cracked. No, that's... it would not be sensible to do that. But that's what you have in a lot of situations in modern politics, where people just immediately dismiss the two sides and say, I'm just going to go in the middle. And then you get these really strange and nonsensical positions that aren't consistent with themselves. You want to slow down the flow of illegal immigration, but you're not willing to actually slow down the flow of illegal immigration. We're supposed to compromise with millions of illegal immigrants being let in every year, and we're supposed to compromise and say, okay, we're going to let in only a few hundred thousand illegal immigrants a year. We're only X million illegal immigrants a year. Why can't they come legally? Why can't that be the starting point? It's like we're starting from the negative and trying to compromise between the actual neutral position, which is that no immigrants coming in illegally, that's a neutral position. The positive from there is, how many are you going to let in legally? You're starting from the neutral and trying to compromise with the negative of, let's let in this many illegal immigrants. And then you're trying to find a point in the middle, and the result is that you're still a negative. That's like saying, we want to spend $10 billion and then saying, Well, no, hold on now. We only make $2 billion. And then the guy who wants to spend $2 billion, like, come on, you have to meet me in the middle. Okay, I want to spend $10 billion. You're saying we can only make $2 billion. You have to meet me in the middle. And so then they compromise on... they meet in the middle at negative $3 billion. That doesn't make any sense. And that's a problem with our modern politics, where people will try to take the middle of the road approach to a standard, normal position and an insane position that has been normalized as though it wasn't insane. Mass illegal immigration is not normal. It's not rational. It's not humane. Look no further than the human trafficking, the child trafficking, the sex trafficking, the drug trafficking, all kinds of trafficking going on at our southern border that is enabled by open borders policies. In no way is this a moderate policy, and it's time that we stop pretending that it was. There's a reason why the Republicans, and increasingly people outside of the Republicans, are saying that the starting point is zero now. It's zero. Zero illegal immigrants. If you're going to come here, you have to come legally, and it's just a point that the pro-immigration side just doesn't accept as a thing. Legal immigration. You hear all this talk about how we have to give these people a pathway to citizenship. That's the only, that's a moderate position. No. They came here illegally. There already is a pathway to citizenship, and it's called legal immigration. But every time something like this happens, where you have an illegal immigrant who is committing crimes against American citizens, who's given slaps on the wrist, I'm sure you've heard about that story of these illegal immigrants who basically jumped the police officers who were trying to arrest one of them. That they jumped them, and they beat them, and then they run. Eventually, some of them were found and caught. Now imagine if you and your friends had tried to gang up on a police officer or two, because there were two in the video. Imagine if you and your friends pulled that stunt. Jail. Behind bars. The cartoon where they'll just be out. I say the cartoon. You know how in cartoons where you'll just see them standing behind the bars as the door slowly closes shut. That'd be you if you tried to pull this. But yet they can go jump a police officer with impunity and then walk off. And then they'll get released by the DA. Are you going to be released by the DA if you pull that? No. You're going straight to jail. You're going to the slammer, the big house, night. You're not leaving either. You assaulted an officer. But every time instances like these happen, every time illegal immigrants are treated better than American citizens, every time there's a different standard applied to people who didn't come here legally, every time there's a different standard applied to them than there is applied to American citizens, the idea that we are somehow obligated to let these people in dies one little, you know, knife wound at a time. It's a death by a thousand cuts, but it is a death, and we're getting closer and closer to the point where we have to do the post-mortem, because illegal immigration is dying as a valid policy position in American politics. Like the chaos of Chicago and New York, the chaos of random people who shouldn't be here just killing American citizens at random, the chaos of the drug trafficking, killing tens of thousands of Americans every year. All this chaos is now being accurately attributed to the open border. And what we're watching is the Overton window of American politics shutting the door on mass illegal immigration. The starting point from now on is zero. And this incident where this young girl lost her life, unfortunately, is just another incident that's going to push America over that edge. Now, I don't know if this incident itself is going to be the tipping point for that, but broader U.S. opinion on immigration is slowly and steadily shifting right over to where Trump is. No one's going to complain when he comes in and on day one gets back to building that wall. No one's going to complain. Precisely because of instances like these. And you know what? If you were aboard the let's let all these people in, they just want a better life, you should have seen this coming. You should have said they have to come legally. You should have laid down the ground rules and then stuck by those ground rules. But we're not living in that world. We're living in this world. And with that will come a proportionate change. It's just a matter of how many more people are going to have to lose their life in instances like these before that change can happen. Because clearly our existing political class isn't going to help the situation at all. But that is immigration. But now we'll get into the final topic of today's episode, which is the primaries. And we'll start with the Michigan primary. So Trump, big Donald J. Trump, big John Trump, has won the Michigan primary 68-26. And I'm talking percentages here. Goddamn. So you remember all that talk and all that bluster about how Nikki Haley, she's the American people, they want a candidate, right? They want an alternative to Trump, and I'm that alternative. I'm gonna stay in the race because the people deserve to vote. This isn't a Soviet style dictatorship where one person is on the ballot. Now look at her. Almost 70% went to Trump. And she was making a big deal about how, he got over 50%, but I mean, 40%, he didn't get 40%, because 40% went to me, okay? That doesn't mean I lost, okay? That's not me losing. That's me demonstrating that there's a voice in the Republican Party that doesn't want Trump. All right, I'm significant. I'm relevant. Please keep giving me money. And now here we are, where he's gotten nearly 70% of the vote, and she barely managed to get a quarter. Now see, if she listened to me and got out the damn race, Nikki Haley wouldn't have been humbled like that. Immediately after losing in her home state, she wouldn't have been humbled like this. But look, you wanted to be hard-headed, and look what that got you. Humbled. On your ass. Ass out in the wind. Cooked, as the kids say. That's all you, all right? That's all you. And now, we're going to move on to the things that matter. So Trump won. He got like 750,000 votes on that. Now, Biden won too, all right? He won too. Wouldn't be fair not to mention that. Although, he got 600,000 votes. Not bad. Not bad. It could have been 700,000. But what happened? 100,000 people in the Democrat primary voted uncommitted. They didn't vote for Biden. They voted uncommitted. And this was done in protest to Biden's policies towards the war in Gaza. And now there were 33,000 in the Republican primary who voted uncommitted, and that'll be an important fact later on. I'll bring that up a little bit later. But going back to this protest vote, as I'm sure you've all heard about a million times by now, Michigan is home, particularly Dearborn, Michigan, is home to a very large American Muslim population, i.e. people who would obviously have a religious or familial or, you know, direct interest in what's happening in Gaza, particularly in the form of opposition to a genocide committed against Arab Muslims in Palestine. And therefore, it's easy to connect the dots that they would be opposed to the guy who gave a blank check to the country executing that genocide. And the guy who gave that blank check was Biden. We all saw it on, like, day two, because he went to Israel almost immediately and goes, we're just going to stand with you, or we stand steadfast with you. And, you know, he wanted to say as long as it takes, but, you know, you have to change up the script every now and then. You just use that with Ukraine, so you got to change the script up a little bit. But, yeah. So the blank check he's given to Israel bites him in the ass more and more every day. And this is no different. And now the media, very, very slimy as always, the news media, the propaganda press, to be specific, you know, they try to make it seem like, oh, this is bad for Trump and Biden. Oh, this is bad for both of them. And this is a part of a larger attempt to sort of conflate the two with being equals. Biden's too old, but Trump's too old too. Well, actually, that's actually a pretty fair criticism. I mean, the guy is good for now, but he's up there in age. Like, there's no guarantee that he's going to be able to go for another 4 years. I mean, that just comes with the territory of being so old. I mean, he's fine for now, but again, that could change at any moment. So that one might actually be a valid criticism. But there's this attempt, voters, they're so tired. The voters are so tired of Trump and Biden. They just want a different option. Is Trump and Biden the best we can do? Like this, like that, because they've, it's now become, acceptable to sort of dump on Biden, because they're ultimately planning to get rid of this guy. So as a part of the plan to get rid of him, now that it's acceptable to sort of trash on him, they're sort of doing the scorched earth. If we go down, if this guy's going down, we're going to take Trump with him. Is Biden and Trump the best we can do? This attempt to sort of make them out to be equals and equally bad for America, it's not going to work, but that's what they're doing. And you see this as a small part of that larger propaganda strategy. Oh, by the 100,000 people voted uncommitted in Michigan. This is bad for Trump and Biden. yeah, no. And look, look, while it is factually accurate that 133,000, because there's that many, 133,000 did not vote for either Trump nor Biden, but instead went out and voted uncommitted, which is beyond just staying home. No, that is a straight up protest vote. That's not sitting on the couch. That's a protest vote. So you can see how many votes you would have gotten, but you didn't get them. But alas, while it is factually accurate that 133,000 people voted uncommitted in the Michigan primary between both the Republican and Democrat primaries, it is not truthful to say that this is bad for both Biden and Trump. It's factually accurate, but not that these people didn't vote for anybody, but it is not being truthful. You're not really telling that. You're lying by omission, but you're being slimy and manipulative when you put it that way. And let me explain. Trump got 750,000 votes in a primary in Michigan, complete with record voter turnout. Right. In any other day, you'd say that's a great thing. This bodes very well for Trump. But Biden, he got 600,000. He's the incumbent. Why is he getting 600,000 and Trump getting 750,000? So right off the bat, it's not like these are bad numbers, mind you. It's just that Michigan is a swing state. And Trump is up by 150,000 votes over Biden. But it wouldn't be that big of a gap were it not for these 133,000 people who showed up to vote and voted for nobody in protest. All right? And so right off the bat, we sort of paint a slightly different picture that, no, Trump is actually doing pretty well. He got 750,000 votes, and he's getting record voter turnout. How is this bad for him? Right? So the question is now asked when we look at the numbers. But when we dig just a little bit deeper, and, you know, we are reminded that these are two separate primaries. When we dig just a little bit deeper, we're reminded that these are two separate primaries. And as I stated earlier, only 33,000 people on the Republican primary voted uncommitted. So out of essentially, well, actually, I'm not entirely sure how many votes Nikki got. But if Trump has nearly 70%, I would assume that she got around 250 to 300,000 votes, is my estimate. I'll just say 250 for the sake of making the math easy for myself. So Trump gets 750,000, 750,000. Nikki gets 260, 270 million, right? Million. Wow. The whole country. Damn, Nikki. 270,000. So that's about a million and some change. And then 33,000, you know? So most of the votes are actually accounted for by the two candidates on the ballot. By an overwhelming majority. It's not even like you're talking like double-digit percentiles voted for nobody. No, most of the votes are accounted for by both of these candidates on the Republican primary. But when you go to the Democrat primary, it's not 33,000 uncommitted. It's 100,000. 100,000. That's a good chunk of what Nikki Haley herself got, right? That's a presidential opposition. That's the kind of numbers that the uncommitted vote got in the Democrat Michigan primary. Like, numbers that would put a political candidate on the map is how many people voted uncommitted in the Michigan primary on the Democrat side. 33,000 on the Republican side, 100,000 on the Democrat side. And that 100,000 meant something, mind you, because Biden got 600,000 votes. 100,000 on top of that, if he had earned these voters, that would have put him in a comparable range with Trump. Trump got 750,000, 750,000. Had Biden got these uncommitted voters to commit to him, no pun intended, he would have been at 700,000, roughly. That's comparable to Trump. He's down by 150,000 votes, because, one, 100,000 people didn't vote for him, whereas only 33,000 on the Republican side didn't vote for Trump. So if we're talking about missed potential. If we're talking about mobilizing voters here, Trump has more successfully mobilized voters to his side than Biden has, to the point where he is up by 50,000, even if Biden got all 100,000 of those uncommitted votes. To the point where he would only be up by 80,000, by only 30,000 additional votes, had he gotten all of the uncommitted votes in Michigan on the Republican primary. So what that suggests is that Trump isn't the one struggling for voters here. At the very least, not in Michigan, he isn't. Trump's not the one struggling for voters. Biden is. And in the specific county of Dearborn, Michigan, where the Muslim population is much higher and much more concentrated, in Dearborn, Michigan, Biden lost to the uncommitted vote. Trump didn't lose to the uncommitted vote. He won every county in Michigan. But that, be weary of these little manipulative, little slimy tricks that these people try to play when they're technically using facts. These are facts that 130,000 people didn't vote. But always dig just a little bit deeper so that you don't get deceived by these people. Because they are deceitful. They love to be deceitful. And Trump is right in calling them the enemy of the people, because their job is to tell the truth. Not just to tell the facts, their job's to tell the truth, right? And part of the division in this country, to the extent that there is a division, it's just not as extreme as people like to make it out to be. To the extent that there is a division in this country, it is from people trusting these people, these propaganda sources that parade themselves off as news, and from people who don't trust them. And that's a damn shame, because we should be able to have news sources that we can trust, because those sources don't tell you the facts and try to deceive you with them, but because they tell you the facts so that you understand the truth. That's what these people are supposed to do. That's what the free press is supposed to do. Instead, you have randoms like me taking to podcasts to sort of navigate around this, and, you know, I'm just venting my geopolitical views, and in this case, my political views on the American election, which will have geopolitical implications, but I'm an American, so, you know, I'm just going to talk about these things. But it really shouldn't have to come down to me, right? It really shouldn't. Like, we can celebrate the rise of the podcast as a medium of news, because it's a lot of people are going to be just orders of magnitude more informed than they otherwise would be listening to these propagandists. But it's a damn shame that there isn't even, like, real competition here. Because why do we have to find alternatives to you? Not because it's easier for us, which it is, to listen to a podcast, but because you lie. Why should it have to be this way? But alas, they're going out the window too. The propaganda machine for the empire is dying right alongside the empire that it serves. And good riddance. Good riddance. But we're not here just to talk about the primary. Before I go, I do want to talk about something else. Because the primary is important, right? It is important. And no, it's not bad for Trump. It's very bad for Biden. Especially if what we see here carries over into the general election. If it does carry over into the general, Biden's going to lose Michigan. Just hands down. He's going to lose Michigan. And it's going to be ugly. It's going to be ugly. And we're going to know exactly how it happened. So this is bad for Biden, not Trump. Don't let these people deceive you. But tomorrow is Super Tuesday. And more than just one primary is going to happen. A lot of primaries are going to be happening all at once across the country. Now, not all the other primaries are going to be taking place here. My state is taking place 2 weeks after Super Tuesday. But a lot of states are going to be having their primaries, and this is effectively the day that decides who their nominee is, because so many delegates are going to be assigned on this day that if you are, unless it's a really, really close contest, we're going to know who the nominee is by the end of Super Tuesday. It's like that. So with that comes the issue of being on the ballot. Now, so far, Trump hasn't had really any issues being on the ballot, but on Super Tuesday, he technically would, because, you know, the states that have taken him off the ballot would have had the opportunity to do so by then. And what I mean by that is he hasn't, none of the primaries that have happened right now were in states where his name was supposedly taken off the ballot. Super Tuesday, two of those states, Illinois is one, Maine is the other, and then there's obviously Colorado. Two of those three states are having primaries on Super Tuesday. And they supposedly took his name off the ballot. Now, they stayed the decision, right? So they made the decision, and then they stayed it, which means that it doesn't go into effect unless the Supreme Court sort of rules in their favor. So, again, that's why I say technically he's off the ballot, but in practice, he would still have been on the ballot anyway, and this is, I refer you to Dr. Steve Turley for breaking that down. But the Supreme Court did make a ruling today, actually, the day before Super Tuesday. And they ruled, wow. Wow, I'll just say that before we even talk about the ruling, but I won't tease you for too long. So today the Supreme Court issued a ruling on the Colorado's attempt to remove Trump, and this went all the way up to the Supreme Court because it has to, because it's a state trying to ban a presidential candidate, so there's no other court it can go to. And the decision came out today, this morning, and to the shock of literally everybody, the court ruled, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled, in a unanimous 9-0 decision. Let me say that again. The Supreme Court of the United States, on the issue of Colorado trying to remove Trump from the ballot, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled in a unanimous 9-0 decision in Trump's favor, saying that states cannot remove him from the ballot. Wow. I wasn't expecting that. No one was expecting that. I don't think people thought it was possible to get a 9-0 decision ever. Ever. Not in today's politics anyway. Like maybe if over time the justices were just changed and were more in line with certain party affiliations instead of being sort of split. Wow. The most people had it like anticipated was like maybe 7-2, but more likely a 6-3 or a 5-4. That was sort of the range. People expected it to go in Trump's favor. I was one of those people. I know I hadn't speculated on how many justices would side with Trump on this one. I'd say it should be 9-0 because it's just blatantly clear that this is a violation of the Constitution. You can't just take him off the ballot because you want to, and you stayed your own decision, so you don't even really mean that. So why should the Supreme Court waste their time with this this folly? I was not expecting 9-0. I don't even think Trump was expecting 9-0. That's a shot across the bow, if I've ever seen one. Like, the absurdity regarding trying to take Trump off the ballot, the Trump derangement syndrome actually got so bad in this election cycle that the Supreme Court found something to be unanimous on. That's impressive. That is actually impressive. But again, this is the right ruling. It should be this way. It should be not just that Trump won, but that it should be 9-0. Because there was no legal basis for taking him off the ballot in the first place. Again, on top of the Colorado court staying their own decision, and the same thing happened with Maine. They made the decision and they stayed it. So you're not even serious about this. You just made the decision just to make it, and now you're going to pause your decision, which makes it irrelevant. Because in the event that Trump wins, he can't run again. And even in the event that he loses, he's going to be too old to run again. But that aside, those disqualifiers themselves aside, when you get to the root of this, which is that, oh, he committed an insurrection, so he's not eligible to be on the ballot, you can't make that determination if he has not been convicted of insurrection. It's simple, innocent until proven guilty. The governing philosophy of our court system. You can't punish somebody for a crime that they haven't committed. You can't punish, and legally speaking, if we're going there, you cannot legally impose repercussions on somebody for a crime that they haven't been convicted of, which is just the extra level above. You can't punish someone for a crime they didn't commit. He hasn't even been convicted of. Like, let's say he did commit this. He hasn't been convicted of the crime. He was acquitted by the House. He was acquitted by the Senate, excuse me, in the second impeachment trial. What was the impeachment trial about? Insurrection on January 6th. And he was impeached and then acquitted. So what are we even talking about here? He was acquitted in 2021 on insurrection. Acquitted of all charges. And not even to mention that none of the people in January 6th who've been in jail or who've been given these effectively life sentences, none of them have been charged with insurrection. None of them have been convicted of insurrection. Trump hasn't been charged with insurrection. Trump hasn't been convicted of insurrection. Well, actually, he has been charged with insurrection. That was what the impeachment, the second impeachment was about. But he has never been convicted. You can't make court rulings without the legal precedent. You can't make a court ruling saying that someone is ineligible to run for office on the grounds that he's committed an insurrection if he hasn't been convicted of an insurrection. What's the legal basis for that decision then? If he hasn't been convicted. There is no legal basis. And that was always the problem. So it was, in my mind, it should have been 9-0, but I didn't expect it to be 9-0 because politics. But here we are. Like, you can't take him off the ballot for insurrection if he hasn't been convicted of insurrection. And now the Supreme Court has finally put this tomfoolery to rest. As they should have, and thank goodness, thank the Lord that they have. Because it's more than just Trump. If you can take someone off the ballot for a crime that they haven't been convicted of, that precedent would go far beyond Trump. And it would allow anybody in power, namely the Uniparty, because Republicans and Democrats are part of the same party, just two wings of the same party, the Uniparty, the establishment, if you will, they'd be able to just take off the ballot whoever was a threat to them. And they would never be able to be removed from power by anything other than forceful means. And so thank goodness that this decision has come down. And we have a good precedent. Because this will set precedent moving forward. Not just in the negative terms, but in the positive. You can't take someone off the ballot for a crime that they haven't been convicted of. This will stand and it'll be used at some point in the future. And people are going to look back on this and go, it's wild that we needed that precedent to be set. But it's going to be this is a really good precedent. It's a shame that something so basic wasn't obvious to everybody. But this is a good precedent to set, and it's a good thing that the Supreme Court has ruled this, and conveniently, right before Super Tuesday. Again, not that Trump's name was going to be off any ballots, because all these places had stayed their decisions. So he was going to be on regardless, but it's the precedent that matters. And this is a really good precedent. So that's one avenue of cheating no longer in play for this election. And right before the first wave of major elections in our country. The second American Revolution presses on. But that, my lovely listeners, is all I've got for you today. I've made a concerted effort to make this one a shorter episode, because last week was 2.5 hours, and I was like, dang, I know people are tired of listening to me talk, so I managed to cut this one down, trim the fat a little bit, you know. Still got a good episode in. But alas, that's all I've got for you today. I do hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast on my geopolitical podcast. The world is changing, folks. And no matter how it changes, we're going to have fun watching it together. Now, I've been your host, Hashan Wade, And you've been listening to This Week in Geopolitics. So till we meet again next Monday, Servus.